Hello and welcome to Yes Indeed Pod, a podcast about indie tabletop role-playing games where I interview creators about their games and inspirations and about the theory, process and practice of game design. My name is Mark Shepherd, your host today and always, and your friendly local indie enthusiast. This month is International Podcast Month, and to celebrate, I'm reaching out to those bastions of the indie scene, actual play podcast showrunners. This week, I'm talking to Ree from the Magpies, an actual play podcast using the Blades in the Dark system. It's an all-woman cast and hits so many social justice issues that it will make your head literally spin. I've been listening for what seems like forever, and it's become one of my firm favourites. Now that's out of my head and into yours, let's talk indie. Today we're interviewing Ree of the Magpies podcast. Welcome to the show, Ree.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Absolutely no problem. Long time fan, so it's always good to have a chat. Would you like to introduce yourself and let us know what you do in indie tabletop role-playing?
Sure. So my name is Ree, pronouns are she and her. I am the GM and producer of the Magpies podcast. We are just wrapping up our third season, or depending on when this comes out in September, season four may have just begun.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah. It's still just kind of wild that this idea I had a few years ago has grown as much as it has. I have a sort of freelance business for the RPG community. It's called Skill Check. I provide copy editing and accessibility consulting to the RPG community. So if you are a game designer and you want to have somebody, you know, copy edit your work or look over your documents to make sure that they're accessible to disabled gamers, you can reach out to me and I can help you with that.
Do you want to tell us a bit more about that? I think you recently did accessibility for a pretty prominent Kickstarter.
Yeah, I am the accessibility consultant on Descent to Midnight, which is a very cool indie Powered by the Apocalypse game about alien undersea creatures that use like psionics and bioengineering to fight against corruption threatening their communities. It's an amazing game, and I'm really excited that I'm able to be part of the team.
Yeah.
The kind of work that I do, you know, the copy editing is pretty straightforward. You know, somebody will send me text that they've written, you know, a full game, an adventure module, a supplemental add-on to a larger game. I'll go through it, make my comments, add commas, fix typos, that sort of thing. The accessibility consulting is that's kind of the more complex piece. With that, I will work with designers to kind of talk about what are they doing in terms of layout, what kind of programs are they using, what are their plans for color and images and all sorts of things. And I'll work with them to make sure that the document is designed in a way that it'll be accessible to people who are using a variety of assistive technologies. So like screen reader software, they'll read the content of like a website or a document out loud to the user.
Yeah.
Or people who use keyboard navigation rather than with a mouse. There's a lot of kind of behind the scenes tags and coding that goes into making sure that those tools can interact with a document or a website properly.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really important because we are a relatively diverse community. I feel like especially the indie space, it's quite visible.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I don't want to be that person that's like, I've been playing, you know, RPGs since whenever, but I have been playing tabletop RPGs since high school, so more than half my life at this point. And it's really been, I would say, in the last 5-7 years, I feel like, as the indie scene, I don't know if these are exactly connected, but I feel like it's probably fair to say that they are, that as the indie scene has gotten bigger and more prominent, it's made it easier for marginalized creators who maybe before wouldn't have been able to get the attention of the big names like, you know, Wizards of the Coast or other things. You know, now you don't have to go through a big publisher. If you want to create your own game, you can just go on, you know, Itch or DriveThruRPG and publish it. And I think that that's led to a big push for diversity.
Yeah.
Within the space. I think part of that has been the disabled community coming forward and being like, hey, we're here too. I tend to focus on kind of the technical side of things, but it's also so much ableism is just kind of baked into a lot of the traditional tropes of RPGs. You know, you have sanity mechanics, or, you know, like in D&D, blindness and deafness are curses that can be put on you. Like, there's a lot of really nasty stuff that I think is now kind of coming to light, and people are starting to reckon with the fact that, like, this is not great, and how can we do better?
Yeah, absolutely. It was quite prominent in the Twitter sphere a couple of weeks ago. There was a combat wheelchair for D&D 5th edition that came out.
Yeah.
Obviously, I see quite a lot of divisive stuff in the TTRPG space. This was one of the most divisive topics I have ever seen, and that was so, so disheartening. So upsetting.
Yeah, and to me, it's also just so strange, I guess, that people would get up in arms about that. Like, one, nobody's making you use this in your game.
No.
If you don't want to, don't. But two, it's also just, I think that there is just this attitude in a lot of non-disabled spaces that disability is something we don't want to talk about, we don't want to think about, we don't want to acknowledge it, because it's painted as such a negative in society generally. You know, disabled people are not part of the community.
Yeah.
And so when someone who is disabled comes out and is like, actually, we're here, and here's a thing that we came up with to better represent our experiences in the world, in this game that we play, it just is like people can't square those two conceptions of disability. And
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of folks, rather than going, oh, wow, this is so cool, I had no idea, and like embracing the opportunity to learn, just dig in their heels and cling to the very narrow view of things that they had before.
Yeah.
As upsetting as it has been to kind of see the pushback against it, I think it also is, like, it's really cool that somebody came up with that. Like, I haven't been able to dig into it as much yet, but like, that's really cool that somebody like took the time to come up with the mechanics and all of that and put it out there. And, you know, for as much negativity as there has been, I have also seen a lot of support coming out for that person.
And people saying, look, we're being represented now. We can see ourselves in the games that we're playing. And that's kind of, that's a wider mood as well, isn't it? For like people of color and queer and trans folks in the indie scene who are saying, actually, Wizards, actually, Onyx Path, we haven't traditionally been represented particularly well in your games. Maybe take a look at yourselves there.
Yeah. I also do want to mention one other really, really great accessibility resource kind of in the RPG space is the Fate Accessibility Toolkit. It's written as kind of a toolkit that goes with the Fate RPG system. It covers so many things. It's amazing. It talks about kind of how to play disabled characters in Fate. And then also how to, if you are a non-disabled GM, kind of how to create an accessible gaming space for disabled players. And I think the best part of it is that even if you don't play Fate, pretty much the whole book was written by disabled people, disabled gamers. There's this huge section that's basically people with all kinds of different disabilities talking about their experiences. So you have, I know Acer Tolentino, who I've worked with on a few things before. He's a blind lawyer and RPG player. He does the Redacted Files.
Oh, yeah.
Him and his wife do that. And so he has a chapter talking about, this is what my experience as a blind person is like.
Right.
There's stuff in there, like from just all kinds of different, you know, physical disabilities, sensory disabilities, mental health disabilities, all kinds of different things, talking about their individual lived experiences so that people who haven't lived with that can get a better sense of how to portray that in a realistic and respectful way in their games.
That's definitely a toolkit that I would be very willing to use. I'd really encourage everybody to go and check that out.
Yeah.
I was on the Evil Hat Itch page the other day. It is definitely on there. It is still in beta, I think. It's not fully arted out yet.
They're basically kind of selling copies in advance to raise the money that they need for the art. Because like one thing they're working on is they have a big section in the back where they are going to be putting a lot of American Sign Language signs that you might need to kind of communicate some more straightforward ideas in an RPG.
Nice.
So it's not enough where you could have a full conversation, but you know, you can kind of incorporate that.
That's really cool. Yeah.
It is really cool. And like I said, even if you're not playing Fate, it's worth a read because a lot of the information in there is applicable to any game that you're playing.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for that. I mean, it's really cool to have all of that information that we've sort of not scratched the surface of that on Yes Indeed before. And I think it's really important to the indie space to be able to get to grips with that accessibility. It's part of what you do for your own podcast. You always provide the transcripts. I think you're most of the way through that now.
We're usually running about a season behind. I have a couple transcriptionists that I work with who are just phenomenal. They're great to work with, and they are helping to transcribe our episodes. But I don't know if you or any listeners have ever tried to transcribe audio, but it is hard. It is a skill that you got to work hard at to develop. And so,
yeah,
you know, it's something where people need to be fairly compensated for their work. So it does get a little expensive. And so we didn't quite have the funding to start doing it in season one. So we're kind of running about a season behind with our transcripts, but we will get there eventually.
Yeah.
And one of my goals for any future podcast projects that I do is figuring out a way to have simultaneously released transcripts. So like the episode goes up and it's got the transcript at the same time.
That would be brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a little ways off. But for the Magpies on our website, we've got the transcripts posted. And I've heard from, you know, some of our audience who has been really grateful for having those, and which is always really nice to hear from folks who are using them.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously very useful and accessible for people who actually need that. So Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah.
So all this month I'm talking to actual play podcasters, who I think are a really important part of the indie space and people who play lots of different games. Yours is a long-running game. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, sure. So The Magpies is a Blades in the Dark actual play. Blades in the Dark is written by John Harper. He has done some other kind of shorter indie games. So Lasers and Feelings is him. Yep. The Mustang.
Lady Blackbird.
Yes, that was the other one.
Aegon.
Yeah, Aegon, I think, is a more recent release.
This is the second edition that's just been re-released.
That's right. You are correct.
Yeah, sorry. I'm kind of a John Harper fanboy.
Yeah, I mean, he does great stuff. And he's been really supportive of the show, which has been fantastic.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, it always just like brightens my week whenever he'll pop into a conversation where people are talking about The Magpies. And he's like, oh my God, The Magpies is great. I love listening. I'm like, oh, yay.
That's fantastic. That would make my day.
In terms of what Blades in the Dark is about, the player characters are a group of scoundrels and thieves and criminals in, it's described as an industrial fantasy setting. So rather than kind of the pseudo medieval renaissance mishmash that you kind of get in more traditional fantasy, industrial fantasy is usually kind of a like Victorian England aesthetic. It's been compared to like the Dishonored video games or Bloodborne for another video game touchpoint. So you have, you know, more advanced technology. There's electricity, there's guns, there's usually one of the big themes is class struggle, where you have that kind of burgeoning divide, really sharp divide between the capitalist upper classes of the factory owners and whatnot, and then the worker class.
Yeah.
That tends to be a pretty big theme. And then the fantasy element of it is usually, again, not very kind of traditional D&D style magic, but rather it tends to lean more into a very haunted feel. So it's a lot of stuff about ghosts and demons and things like that.
Yeah.
I've got my Blades in the Dark book here. I'm just going to, there's a great quote on the first page that basically I think sums up the setting better than I ever could. You're in a haunted Victorian era city trapped inside a wall of lightning powered by demon blood.
Yeah.
That's Blades in the Dark.
It's super cool.
Yeah. And in this setting, you are playing this group of criminals who basically start as nobodies, and you are trying to claw your way up to the top of the heap in whatever district of the city you're in. It's interesting because majority of the responses we've gotten to The Magpies have been overwhelmingly positive. People have been really supportive of the show, and we take a pretty explicit social justice approach to both the stories stories that we tell are our crew started off as thieves. They were very bad at it. They never made money. And they very quickly switched into being vigilantes, where they are explicitly fighting against the powers that be, fighting against corruption and oppression. But we also do that outside of the game. We, you know, have a featured charity of the month. In my intro, I'm pretty much always talking about some kind of political concern that I'm asking people to take action on. I want to say 98%, maybe even, you know, 99% of the response we've gotten has been incredibly supportive of what we're doing. But there's been a handful of people who are like, I really, you know, I wanted to like this, but they're just so political. And it's like, this is such an explicitly political game.
It really is, yeah.
All of the backgrounds that you can have puts you as somebody who is in some way marginalized by society.
Yeah.
Even if you pick, like, the nobility background, clearly not in a privileged position anymore if you're running around with a group of thieves.
Exactly, yeah.
Something has happened to remove you from that status.
Yeah.
It is about being, you know, marginalized from society, living in poverty, living in desperation, and what are you willing to do to get out of that? What are you willing to risk and sacrifice to fight against the people who have all of the money and all of the power?
Yeah, yeah.
It always just, I'm just sort of like, are you familiar with the game at all?
I feel like a lot of people want very apolitical games and they want very apolitical settings.
There's no such thing.
And I think apolitical steampunk is very boring. It doesn't interest me at all. I would usually say I'm not interested in steampunk. And like, this game has a kind of steampunk aesthetic.
It does, yeah, yeah.
And this has been the only steampunk game that I would ever say that I would actually enjoy playing, because it has this edginess and it has this politicization of the working class. And
yeah,
it's truly fantastic. And I love what you do with it. I love the way that you are generally taking the upper classes to task on most of your scores. So
yeah, I mean, it's very easy in these times to get that motivation.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think also, you know, you kind of mentioned that it's got some edginess to it. And I would agree. What I think is also kind of a cool thing about this game is that, like, there's a lot of games that I think take the angle of, oh, we're going to be edgy and grim and gritty and dark. And so to that end, they build in things that they think they need to be gritty and grim and dark, of misogyny and racism and all of these other things.
Yeah. Again, we're looking at you, Onyx Path.
Yeah. Blades in the Dark doesn't do that.
No.
There's nothing in the setting. I mean, there is classism is a huge element of it, obviously. And there is sort of one of the ethnic national backgrounds that you can be from is, I tend to kind of read it as a combination of like Ireland and Eastern Europe, in terms of sort of how it relates to the dominant cultures in the area of Western Europe and England.
It's kind of minority white.
Yes.
The key conflict here is not between other ethnic groups, it's between these two traditionally white ethnic groups who, in Western Europe at least, basically make up a large proportion of the working class. Again, it just reinforces the idea that a lot of this is just about class warfare and praxis.
John Harper is American, so I think he's drawing more on kind of the anti-Irish sentiments.
Right, yeah.
From American history. But, you know, if you're familiar with that, there's some of the stuff that he talks about. It's a very clear parallel to those attitudes during the main wave of Irish immigration.
We have the same thing, so.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. And one thing that I did very explicitly that I laid out for my players is that, like, this is a setting where there isn't really kind of a traditional religious system. Because of the way that the magic fantasy side of things works, the short version is when you die, your ghost, your spirit no longer kind of moves on to another world. It's just trapped here. And ghosts tend to be very dangerous. They prey on the living. And so it's led to this attitude that's kind of an exact inversion of mainstream Christianity, where the soul is the unholy part and the body is sacred. And so the main religion in this setting is the Church of the Ecstasy of the Flesh, which we haven't really gotten into too much in the Magpies, but I kind of took that as, if this is a world where the body is sacred, there's not going to be any stigma about what you do with your body. So, you know, folks who are trans or non-binary or gender fluid, wholly supported. There's alchemy in this setting. There's, you know, alchemicals that can help with any kind of, you know, physical transition that you want to do. I kind of take the approach of, you know, fat phobia is not a thing.
Yeah.
Whatever you're doing with your body, as long as it is good for you and your body and making you feel good and it's not hurting other people, that is good. That is,
yeah,
you know, to some people, that is holy.
That's interesting.
I laid that out very specifically at the beginning of like, and I know that in some games and some narratives, some people do kind of want to grapple with some of those real world bigotries. I don't.
Nope.
And so I'm like, this is a world where that doesn't exist.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's another one of the things about Blades in the Dark as well, is that, I mean, you've mentioned it there implicitly, but it's a game which is implicitly sex positive, which I think is,
yeah,
like kind of a breath of fresh air in games, you know. I like that a lot. There's no kind of stigma or judgment about anything, and it's not there in black and white that says it. It's there kind of between the lines, and that's really nice.
Like you said, it doesn't explicitly say any of this stuff, but I think it's very easy to build in that direction.
Yeah.
Similarly, you know, aside from kind of the conflict with Skovlin, there are a number of other places in the world where people who come from that are, you know, described as being, you know, black or brown, and that is not a problem.
Yeah, that's just a thing.
Yeah, that's just part of the world. Yeah, there's none of that kind of traditional, what we see in the world, racism. There is still some hostility between some of these groups because we're dealing with an empire that forcibly conquered all of these places, and a lot of those people are not happy about being conquered, but that is again about the politics of it and not the skin color.
Exactly, yeah.
Just sort of in the way that the world building is handled, it gives you a good outline, but it leaves a lot of space for you to fill in color and detail.
Yeah, it's a really good palette.
Yeah, and I think it really gives a lot of space to make a setting. It's not a pleasant place,
no.
The Blades in the Dark setting. Like, it is a grim and hard world, but it can still be bleak without having to be racist against people who are black and brown, without having to bring homophobia or transphobia or acephobia into it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have done just fine across three seasons of driving home how much the setting sucks without falling into any of that.
Yeah, what you've done is really good. It's interesting to hear you talk about the underlying themes of it, because that really comes through. You know, you have very strong social justice themes that do shine through every episode, and you can, I don't know if you try to do this, but you can see real world parallels with what you're talking about and the way that you explore some of the issues through the themes of the show. So, you know, kudos. Yeah. Basically, it's very good.
Yeah, I mean, I know we can always do better. Like, one other thing, you know, that I want to be better at with any future projects is, like, right now the whole cast is white, and anything else we do in the future, we are not going to have 100% white cast, because there's just no excuse for it at this point. So we're going to do better on that. You know, I don't want to stand up here and be like, I have achieved perfect social justice representation, because, like, I'm a white cis woman, middle class. Like, I I am going to mess up and struggle and do things that are harmful. But, you know, I try to listen to folks, I try to change, and I'm trying to look for ways that we can continue to improve. And
yeah,
it's kind of what I hope to see continuing sort of in the broader RPG space.
I sort of feel like the premise of your show was that you were going to do an all-woman cast, and that's,
yes,
cool. You know, you've, yep, already turned one of the kind of standard tropes of gaming groups upside down there.
Yeah.
So yeah, sure. In the future, maybe do it differently. But it's a pretty wonderful space at the moment, and it's one that I really admire. I was sort of wondering about, you know, in terms of system as well as setting, like, what do you think it is about Blades in the Dark that makes it so accessible for actual play because there are so many of them out there now.
Yeah, it was interesting because like when I started this, I couldn't find any other ones.
No, I'd found a lot of one-shots and then I really wanted to listen to a Blades one.
a lot of folks who would do, you know, mini arcs or one-shots of it. Yeah, I think there's a lot of very cool things that Blades does that I just love mechanically, you know, kind of independent of how it fits into an actual play. One thing that lends itself really well to campaign play is the fact that in addition to character sheets, you have like a character sheet for the crew as a whole.
Yeah.
So the crew levels up and gets experience and unlocks new abilities and you can change your crew type. And I think that lends itself very well towards long-term play because it creates a sense of unity with these characters.
Yeah.
And it gives you goals to work towards. Like one of the things on the crew sheet is this claims map where you basically have stuff like, you know, informants or an infirmary or good publicity or, you know, a friendly blue coat. And so you can just be like, ooh, if we get that, it lends us this mechanical benefit and then this narrative benefit. And so it kind of gives you targets to work towards.
Targets to work towards together. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's nice.
Things to kind of build your crew up into. You know, it also is a good way to track, like, how much attention are you drawing from the authorities and what do you need to do about that? I think that helps a lot. I think another thing mechanically is that, you know, it's a pretty simple system. The core mechanics are very simple, and there's a lot of kind of add-on mechanics that you can attach, like other systems. But if you forget about one of those, it's fine. The game still runs perfectly.
It really fails forward, doesn't it? Like, if you mess up, who cares? It doesn't matter.
Yeah. It's the rules are very forgiving. Whereas, you know, I think I think just going back to D&D is kind of a touchstone where it's like, oh, I did the math on this roll wrong and your character actually is dead now.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a pretty substantial change.
The other thing is that actually with Blades in the Dark and Forged in the Dark spin-offs, it's really hard to kill a character. You have to, as a player, you have to opt to die.
Yeah.
There's no unexpected player death, you know, which I think makes people take big risks, and that's so exciting to listen to. You know, you hear Josie like say, oh yeah, I'm gonna just try and run this guy through. You know, and it's like, you know, you probably wouldn't hear that much recklessness in another actual play podcast. I think it's the thing that, you know, really heightens the drama in these games, and that's very much what John Harper's game is about. You know, it's about recklessness and taking risks and making it look cool, because that's the touchstones that he's going for.
Yeah, it's a very player driven game, which I think also helps, because Blades in the Dark made me into a good GM, because previously I had been coming from games like D&D where the expectation is that the GM comes in with a story and then the players kind of work their way through it. With Blades in the Dark, if you are comfortable enough with improv, you can, as a GM, walk into a game, sit down and go, okay, guys, what are we doing today? And your players will tell you what they want to do.
Yeah.
For an actual play, I don't often do that because we are trying to construct a more kind of cohesive narrative. So I do a little more planning, but not a ton. And a lot of times my planning is, here's your goal, and then they will tell me how they're going to accomplish it. And the ways that they come up with are sometimes way different than what I expected. I think the best example of that is the season one finale, where it was kind of this big climactic event of this organization that the Magpies had been fighting against kind of struck back and burned down a huge section of a neighborhood in retaliation for things the Magpies had done. And, you know, I put out there, they're like, oh yeah, this area burned down, and now one of the members of this group is going to build like a weapons factory and tenements on the site, and it's going to be horrible for the neighborhood. What are you going to do?
Oh yeah.
I expected them to, like, I don't even remember what I expected. I think possibly blackmail or assassination attempts, something where they went after the specific person who was doing this. Instead, they came up with the idea of a ghost riot. where they were like, oh, a ton of people just died in this fire. Let's get their ghosts and drive out everybody who's trying to occupy this space. And then bring in all the refugees who got kicked out of there to hold it. And I was just kind of sitting here listening to them plan this. And I'm like, this is so much better than anything I could have thought of.
Absolutely, yeah. It gives the players a lot of agency to come up with the story themselves. And that takes a lot of the work off the GM in a way. It's kind of like a shared GMship, especially in terms of story arc. And that's really helpful, especially when we haven't got time necessarily to do our prep between sessions. It's just very useful to have these tools that say, oh, actually, let's just let the players do that and we can concentrate on telling the story in the moment.
Yeah, I think as you were saying with the how player death is handled, that applies to any kind of consequence. Players have a resource that's called stress. Anytime I tell them that something bad happens, be it, you know, you take physical harm or you end up in a worse position or anything bad happens, up to and including your character dies, they can just look at me and go, no. It doesn't. I'm going to resist that. I will roll some dice. I will spend some stress. But they can always say no to whatever bad things I have thrown at them, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Because it can also lead to some very cool character moments of what are they kind of willing to take? You know, what are these characters willing to take on in terms of consequences in order to get to their goals? And then there's also a mechanic that I love called the Devil's Bargain, which is where when you're about to make a roll, you can ask me as the GM for kind of an additional consequence that will happen independent of the result of the roll. You can roll a critical success and this thing that it has happened is still going to happen. But if you accept the Devil's Bargain, you get an extra die on the roll.
Yeah.
And I love that. Minna is my favorite with this because she'll go, can I have a devil's bargain? I have an idea for one. And I'm just like, sure, tell me what terrible thing you'd like to happen to Myra.
Again, it all reinforces this idea that your characters just don't have good impulse control. And they fail or succeed basically because they are lucky, but also because they are reckless. It's just a great way to reinforce that. And it makes for really good stories, you know.
Yeah, one of the cool things about the mechanics is so the way the dice rolls work is you have these different actions you can take. So, you know, prowl or tinker or command, and you have a number of dots in each of those. And, you know, however many dots you have, that's how many dice you roll. If you have no dice in something, you would roll 2d6 and take the lower result. However, you can push yourself, you know, you take some stress to push yourself to get an extra die. And then a friend can take a little bit of stress and give you an extra die. So basically, baked into the mechanics is this idea that with enough internal will and help from your friends, you can do anything.
Yeah, and that's punk as hell.
Yeah, it's really cool. Like, even if it's something that you have never done before, you can just kind of dig into these inner reserves and get an assist from a friend. And if you're rolling 2d6... you can get a critical success on something you have no skill in, which is really cool.
It's so cool. Yeah, it's a good system. Yeah.
Yeah, I love it a lot. And I love just that it's grown out into this forged in the dark branch of indie games where people are doing just such cool things with it. I know for International Podcast Month, I was a player in Songs for the Dusk, which is Blades in the Dark is essentially a post-apocalyptic game. Songs for the Dusk is also post-apocalyptic, but it is a decidedly hope-punk take on it. I'm trying to think of how to describe it. It's a really, really cool game, but basically, yeah, kind of hope-punk, solar-punk, I think are kind of the best descriptors of it, where you're building on the ruins of the old world. Civilization was in a golden age, something happened, and everything collapsed, and now people are rebuilding from it, but like, the rebuilding has been very collaborative and community-based, and the game that we played was a ton of fun. It's just really cool because, you know, they're both post-apocalyptic games.
Yeah.
But they went in such wildly different directions with it. And it's very cool.
Yeah.
I feel like for me, at least, I don't know if this is one of the touchstones that the creator used for Songs for the Dusk, but it has a little bit of like a Breath of the Wild, the Legend of Zelda game vibe to it. We're like, the world ended and things were bad and people are still struggling. It's not the way that it used to be, but like, it's not all gloom and doom and suffering constantly. Like,
right.
You've got these, you know, adventures you can have and these, you know, beautiful scenery. And it's very nature focused. It's kind of built into that.
Pretty cool. That sounds wonderful.
The other one that I've had a chance to play is somebody did a magical girl game, Girl by Moonlight.
Oh, yeah.
That Evil Hat is publishing.
I'd never really sort of associated that with Forged in the Dark, but it is, of course. Wow, yeah, so cool.
I got to play it recently. Yeah, it's a ton of fun.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Go and check that out. Yeah, it's a big space. Yeah, I think we've had several designers on who've done Forged in the Dark things now.
It's very cool to see how people are just kind of taking these mechanics that I enjoy a lot. It's a really cool system. It does a lot of cool stuff and just iterating on it and going in different new directions. And there's some things where I just am looking at it and I'm like, oh man, that's such a cool concept for a mechanic or how to change that up and apply it to your setting. I love seeing people do that. The one thing that's tough about doing a show that is, you know, a long-running campaign is that I can't try out other games on the show.
Yeah, you do the occasional side story.
Right now, we're doing Leviathan Song, which is kind of, it's not really a Forged in the Dark game, it's just sort of an add-on to Blades in the Dark, but we also did Band of Blades.
Band of Blades is great.
Yeah, it's Forged in the Dark meets like wargaming, which is wild and not at all like the kind of thing that I'm usually into, but one of the creators ran a game for us and it was an absolute blast. And again, it's something that just does a lot of really cool stuff with the mechanics.
It does. It's really good. Anybody who hasn't checked out Band of Blades, please go and check it out because it's absolutely fantastic. It is probably my favorite Forged in the Dark game.
And if you'd like to kind of hear a sample of play, we do have a bonus episode of it.
Yeah.
So you can kind of hear a one-shot episode. I don't know how many other places have done Band of Blades.
I've definitely heard at least two. but yeah, yours is the main one, and it's really good. So, Reed, do you want to tell us where we can find you and the Magpies on the internet?
Yes. So you can find the Magpies at magpiespodcast.net. You can also follow us on Twitter at magpies_pod. In terms of where you can find me, if you want to check out Skillcheck, you can find that at rpgskillcheck.net. And you can follow me on Twitter at Rhiannon42. I will warn you that I am currently largely on a Twitter hiatus. I'm only checking in on the weekends for the sake of my mental health. So I am probably not going to be the most active person you can follow on Twitter. You are welcome to do so. I do post occasionally. I'm more active on the Magpies one just because I want to keep up with our fans over there.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are pretty much the best places to find us. Oh, the Magpies also has a Patreon if you want to check that out. It is patreon.com/magpiespodcast. We have just a ton of like behind the scenes stuff over there. If you listen to the show and want to support us, you can do that.
Wow. Fantastic. I encourage everybody to check out the Magpies because it is definitely one of my favorite shows.
Oh, thank you so much.
I suppose all that remains is for me to say thank you very much again for coming on the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This was a ton of fun.
No problem. And yeah, goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. And thanks again, Ree, for the interview. As always, you can find all of the links in the episode description. In the next bonus episode, I'll be talking to Logan from Very Random Encounters, an actual play podcast where as much as possible is subjected to randomization, and for the next series, that includes the game as well. Its seasons are pretty short, so it straddles that gap between one-shot and campaign-length actual plays. It's also a lot of fun, so I encourage you to check it out. I also suggest checking out Logan's other podcast, Game Mechanics Cast, which as an interview show for game designers occupies a similar space to this one. I was a guest earlier in the year and it's a great listen. If you like Yes Indeed Pod, you're going to love Game Mechanics Cast. If you enjoy Yes Indeed Pod, please rate and review the show wherever you find your podcasts, or consider donating through the Ko-Fi page at ko-fi.com/yesindeedpod. Of course, you can always reach out to me through Twitter at Yes Indeed Pod. That's YesIndiedPod. I'd love dearly to hear from you. Lastly, music credits. All music this week is from As I Figure by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com and filmmusic.io. Thanks, Kevin. Until next time, remember, does indie need you? Yes, indeed.